Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, September 12th, 2022. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks for joining us. Here are some headlines. President Biden is in Boston today, as we just heard, giving a speech on his Cancer Moonshot Initiative. He appeared at the JFK Library on the 60th anniversary of President Kennedy's moon landing speech. And earlier in the day, President Biden spoke at Boston's Logan Airport, touting the ways last year's bipartisan infrastructure law will improve the passenger experience and reduce emissions at the nation's airports. We'll hear from the president on his Cancer Moonshot project coming up. Ukrainian troops have reclaimed a wide swath of territory from Russia over the past few days, pushing all the way back to the northeastern border in some places. The Associated Press reports that the Ukrainian military has recaptured territory at least twice the size of Greater London, and its troops have freed more than 20 settlements just in the past day. Meanwhile, both Ukraine and Russia have shown interest in creating a protection zone around the Russia-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. That's according to the top UN nuclear watchdog agency. The goal is to prevent military activities like the shelling that's damaged the plant's power lines from threatening the plant's security. Lawyers for Donald Trump have asked a federal judge to deny the Justice Department's request to immediately restart a key part of its criminal investigation into the top-secret documents found at the former president's Florida home. Trump's legal team argued that the seized records, marked as classified, should remain off-limits to both the FBI and prosecutors until a so-called special master has vetted all of them. The response came after the Justice Department said last Thursday it planned to appeal a federal district court judge's approval of a special master. They also asked the judge to approve a partial stay that would exclude some 300 classifieds from their review. We begin on Capitol Hill, where the Senate will spend most of the week voting on more of President Biden's federal appeals court nominations. The House is back from its summer recess tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern. Lawmakers are expected to pay tribute to the late Queen Elizabeth and vote on a resolution honoring her. Three new members will also be sworn in the House, two representing New York State and one from Alaska, replacing the late longtime Congressman Don Young. And later in the week, the House will vote on legislation changing U.S. Census Bureau operations. One other item on the Senate's agenda, a bill on marriage equality. And during leader time remarks, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer talked about the Respect for Marriage Act. He also mentioned the upcoming deadline to keep the government funded.
Off the Senate floor, my colleagues continue to have good conversations on very important legislation to codify marriage equality into law. Far from being a theoretical exercise, codifying marriage equality would have a dramatic long-term impact on millions of people. At a time when our rights are under siege, it would be a much-needed shield for scores of Americans at risk of discrimination simply because of who they love. For many of us in this chamber, myself included, passing marriage equality would hit home in a very personal way. I want to thank my colleagues from both sides of the aisle, especially Senators Baldwin, Collins, and Sinema, for all the work they're doing to build support for marriage equality legislation. Over the past several months, I've given them the time and space they have requested to have these talks, because I want their efforts to succeed. I know their work is not yet done, and I encourage them to keep going. I truly hope, for the sake of tens of millions of Americans, that there will be at least 10 Republicans who will vote with us to pass this very important bill. We cannot forget that a mere decade ago, marriage discrimination was the law in much of the country. While we're happy that America's made a lot of progress since then, we're not naive in thinking we can't go backwards. As we saw earlier this year, it took the Supreme Court just a few weeks to unravel decades of vital precedent on women's rights, gun safety, and environmental protection. And, of course, Judge Thomas has opened the door for the court to go even further backward when he's saying that cases like Obergefell, which protect marriage equality for now, should be revisited. So when some Republicans say, oh, this is unnecessary, it won't happen, remember, that's the same thing they said about Roe. And look at where we are today. We should protect marriage equality now, well before the MAGA-controlled Supreme Court steps in. So I encourage my colleagues to continue these conversations. The American people support protecting marriage rights of same-sex marriages by large margin. So let's get it done. Finally, on the legislative front, on the CR, both parties must work together to keep the government open beyond the September 30th deadline. As my colleagues know, negotiations continue on a CR to extend funding through about mid-December, which hopefully will give appropriators enough time to draft an omnibus funding package. I thank Chairman Leahy, Ranking Member Shelby, and everyone from both sides working to keep the government open. No one wants to see a shutdown, and I know that includes my Republican colleagues. But in order to avoid a shutdown, Senate Republicans must continue working with us to resolve the issues that remain.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer earlier today on the floor. And in his leader time remarks, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell talked about tomorrow's Labor Department Consumer Price Index data report.
Tomorrow, the Labor Department will release the latest monthly update on the Democrats' inflation. But of course, the American people hardly need government statisticians to explain to them that Washington Democrats' reckless spending has sent prices skyrocketing. Working families have been feeling their pain in their pocketbooks every single day. Nearly two-thirds of middle-income Americans say inflation is negatively affecting their finances. An outright majority say they're experiencing financial hardship. A third of the country says they're struggling to meet basic family needs. One parent shopping for school supplies recently told reporters, "I had to start early because the prices are so high. Being a parent, I wanted to give them the world. Sometimes I wish I could give them more. But the back-to-school rush isn't the only headache facing working families." Since President Biden and this all-Democratic government took office, prices on grocery store essentials from meat to produce have seen double-digit percentage increases. Some household items like furniture are over 20% more expensive than they were on Inauguration Day. The diesel fuel that moves practically everything through the supply chain and onto store shelves is up nearly 80% since President Biden put his hand on the Bible. Households' electric bills are up an average of 20% since January of 2021. Commuting and running errands cost more, with gasoline up 70%. And as fall and winter approach, homes that burn fuel oil are set to be more than 75% more expensive simply to keep warm. The American people know who created this mess. They remember quite well how Washington Democrats spent the spring of 2021 dining out on left-wing spending and leaving taxpayers to pick up the bill. And poll after poll has shown they're overwhelmingly dissatisfied with what President Biden and his party have done since then. One survey found five consecutive times that more than 70% of Americans say our country is headed in the wrong direction. But that hasn't stopped Washington Democrats from calling the same disastrous play over and over and over again.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the floor earlier today. With more on the September 30th government funding deadline and what else Congress has on its plate, here's NBC News senior congressional correspondent Scott Wong.
Well, as you know, John, funding runs out for the government on September 30th. And so we are weeks away from a potential government shutdown. This time around, things look to be a little bit easier than perhaps past moments. But again, it's a difficult time for lawmakers. They are thinking ahead to the election. Nobody wants a government shutdown right before the election. But at the same time, these things are never easy. And so there's a number of challenges that sort of lie ahead. And one of the top challenges, I would just say, is Joe Manchin was able to get a deal with Chuck Schumer and the congressional leadership in the White House when they passed the Inflation Reduction Act. And he was able, as you've probably discussed on this program before, to secure a bill, one of his bills, that would reform and ease permitting for domestic energy projects around the country, things like oil and natural gas pipelines. Well, progressives in his own party, as you can imagine, are pretty upset with any possibility that that permitting proposal would be attached to the government funding bill. And so Manchin and Schumer have this agreement. It's going to be part of the CR Schumer has allowed. But now progressives are up in arms, and they're not threatening a shutdown, but they are very upset. 70 House Democrats, led by Raul Grijalva, have sent a letter to Pelosi saying, separate these two items. Don't package it all together. This is just one of the potential hiccups that are coming down the road.
The editorial board of the Wall Street Journal today actually picking up on that topic. The Manchin permitting watch is the headline of one of their lead editorials. If Democratic critics can't block it, can they make him shrink it? So that's one of the pieces of legislation that's being looked at here. The reason why is these continuing resolutions, as they're called, are kind of must-pass legislation, right? This is, if you want to keep the government open, you have to pass this bill. So everybody wants to try to attach their legislation to that because it's a great vehicle for moving things through Congress. So what else could be possibly attached to a continuing resolution to keep the government funded?
So the White House has their own set of priorities, $47 billion, a supplemental package that would cover things like additional aid, military aid, economic aid for Ukraine, an issue that we've seen come up time and time again. Well, they need more money, and so the Biden administration wants to send them an additional $11.7 billion. Things like COVID relief, monkeypox relief. This is a big portion of that $47 billion. Republicans say, well, we don't need so much money right now for COVID. We've already passed billions and billions of dollars during this past Congress. And so that is an area of contention. Finally, $6.5 billion for disaster relief. That includes things like helping folks who experienced flooding in the past year. We've seen floods in places like Kentucky and around the country, wildfires out in California and the West. And so this would be natural disaster relief money. It's uncertain whether any of that will be eventually attached to this CR, but look, Mitch McConnell is representing Kentucky, has talked about the flooding issue before. He knows that his people are hurting. I'm sure that is one of his priorities, to be able to help his people in Kentucky.
Let's just do a little bit of how a bill becomes a law and how many votes a continuing resolution needs in the House and Senate, because folks may be confused because we've done this budget reconciliation process, which is sort of an alternative set of rules on how a bill can become a law. So if for a continuing resolution to be passed, for the government to stay funded, what needs to happen basically in Congress?
Well, we have the filibuster. And so for any major piece of legislation, barring the reconciliation process, which only needed 50 Democratic votes, most pieces of legislation need 60. And so what that means in this particular United States Senate is you need all the Democrats to hold together. You need at least 10 Republicans to join those Democrats. If somebody like Bernie Sanders peels off and says, I don't want to support this CR because you've attached the Joe Manchin, energy legislation to that, then you'll need additional Republicans to join in. That's where the Chuck Schumer's job becomes quite a difficult task in sort of cobbling this coalition. What can actually, which sets of lawmakers can come together and join hands and pass a CR? Then it gets sent over, as you know, to the House of Representatives, where you need a simple majority. Should be an easier lift for Nancy Pelosi, but again, nothing is very easy in this United States Congress.
And then, of course, a president's signature to put the bill into law. We're talking about the week ahead, the road ahead on Capitol Hill, and we're peeking ahead a few weeks as well, cheating a little bit on our week ahead in Congress segment this morning. Stepping away from the continuing resolution in government funding, another item on the to-do list, as you note in a great wrap-up for NBC News recently, the protecting legal same-sex marriage effort in Congress. Explain what that is and where Democrats are on that effort.
Yeah, John, this is a response to actually the Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court to overturn the Roe v. Wade, longstanding decision. And so senators, Democrats, and a handful of Republicans said, look, we may need to, if the United States Supreme Court can step in and overturn something, a precedent like Roe v. Wade, well, perhaps they can overturn other longstanding precedents like, you know, like gay marriage, like the protection for the use of contraception. And so this bill, sponsored by Tammy Baldwin, she's teaming up with Susan Collins, the Republican from Maine, would basically enshrine and protect same-sex marriage as well as interracial marriage as a right. This is a priority of Tammy Baldwin, of course. She is the first openly gay senator to be elected. And so right now, things are a little bit in limbo. There was some discussion that maybe they would attach that same-sex marriage bill to the CR and use that as a vehicle to move it forward. But what Baldwin and Chuck Schumer have said in recent days is they want to move that separately. They think the best chance for that is to hold a standalone vote on that bill. And so there are negotiations happening. There are some concerns raised by the right about protections for religious freedom, whether or not religious freedom would be infringed by the Tammy Baldwin bill. So there are a lot of bipartisan negotiations, and they're looking for sort of that middle ground.
What is Susan Collins saying to you? Does she say that there's nine of her Republican colleagues who will join her to get to that 60-vote threshold?
They're not saying that yet. They're saying that they're hopeful that it can pass. But when you sort of go ahead and count all of the heads or noses, you know, Rob Portman is a yes. Tom Tillis is a yes. But that does not get you to 10 Republicans, as we discussed, to overcome a Republican filibuster. There are a number of Republicans who are opposed to doing anything. They just don't feel like it's necessary. They don't feel like there is any sort of movement by this Supreme Court on that issue. And so, you know, they're not quite there yet. There's still a lot of behind-the-scenes wrangling that are happening, particularly in regard to this religious freedom concern. But we should know in the coming days, and we should see perhaps language from Baldwin and Collins on religious freedom.
And let me just lob one more issue, and this is why we have you here,
sure,
Scott, because you can do all of this. The Senate grapples with election reform legislation as time runs short to act. That's the headline of your story from this weekend. Explain.
Yeah, election reform. Obviously, we're talking about this in the context of January 6th. The attack on the Capitol, just over your shoulder here, the attempt to try to encourage or pressure the vice president and members of Congress to overturn the election of Joe Biden. And so there has been a discussion happening, again, involving these folks in the middle, Susan Collins, a number of the same individuals who have been, Joe Manchin, another one. So Joe Manchin and Susan Collins working on election reform. They've got two bills, one dealing with reforming the Electoral Count Act, this archaic law from 1887, which sort of walks you through this process of how the vice president and the Congress certify and count electoral votes that are sent from the states. They want to make sure that it's airtight, that there's no room for any sort of funny business that we saw after the 2020 election. That is one of the bills, Electoral Count Act. The other deals with election security, enhancing penalties for people who are pressuring, intimidating poll workers, election officials, also enhancing security for any sort of electronic voting systems. And so that was a big focus of the 2020 election. These are responses to what we saw on January 6th and the run-up to January 6th. Right now, it looks like these issues are going to be punted, John, into the lame duck session. There's simply not enough time in the calendar to do CR as well as election reform.
It's NBC News senior congressional correspondent Scott Wong. You can see more at cspan.org/Washington Journal and on the free C-SPAN Now video app. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more headlines. Politico Europe is reporting that only foreign heads of states and their spouses have been invited to Queen Elizabeth's state funeral on September 19th. The report says leaders have also been asked to arrive in the UK on commercial flights and are banned from using helicopters to get around. And instead of using their own state cars, they will be bused from a site in West London to the event. According to the Politico report, the reason is that Westminster Abbey will be so packed for the event that it will be impossible for more than a single senior representative per country and their other half to attend. The White House typically sends full delegations of leaders to the funerals of foreign leaders. Multiple former presidents attended the 2013 funeral for former South African President Nelson Mandela, for example. You can read more at politico.edu. Also in London today, King Charles addressed Parliament for the first time as the United Kingdom's head of state. We'll hear from him and from parliamentary leaders coming up. Some Senate Republicans are coming out against former President Trump's promise to grant pardons to the January 6th rioters. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who was one of the former president's closest allies, told The Hill that promising pardons is, quote, a bad idea, and that they are given, or supposed to be given, to, quote, people who admit misconduct and rehabilitate themselves. Kevin Cramer, the senator from North Dakota, called promising, quote, giveaways to particular individuals. And Mike Rounds of South Dakota said, quote, I think there was an insurrection, and I think these folks need to be punished. You can read more at thehill.com. A new poll shows Democratic Representative Tim Ryan and Republican J.D. Vance are running neck and neck in the race for Ohio's open Senate seat. The USA Today's Suffolk University poll found 47% of Ohio voters said they favor Representative Ryan if the Senate election were held today, while 46% said they support J.D. Vance. 6% were undecided. And Democrat Katie Hobbs announced that she will not debate Republican Carrie Lake in the race to become Arizona's next governor. Hobbs campaign manager Nicole DeMont called Carrie Lake, quote, a conspiracy theorist, and that a debate would, quote, only lead to constant interruptions, pointless distractions, and childish name-calling. Carrie Lake tweeted on Sunday that her opponent wants to, quote, hide from me, the press, and the voters throughout the entirety of this campaign and run out the clock on the people of Arizona. How clean are the air and water in your state? According to U.S. News and World Report, the three most polluted states are Louisiana, Nevada, and Indiana. The least polluted, Vermont, New Hampshire, and South Dakota. The ratings were based on 2021 EPA data on air and water emissions from industry and utilities and overall measures to long-term human health effects. You can read more at usnews.com. In London today, King Charles III addressed Parliament for the first time as the United Kingdom's head of state. He also received condolences from British lawmakers. The event took place in Westminster Hall before both houses of Parliament. Here's Lord Speaker John McFall at today's event.
She was both a leader too and a servant of her people. Her humility and integrity commanded the respect and captured the imagination of peoples and nations across the globe. Her late Majesty's joyous, unstinting, and reassuring presence across the years made it difficult to contemplate that her long and inspiring reign of deep and unparalleled devotion would ever end. We and the nation closed our eyes to this inevitability. But it has ended. Only a few months after we celebrated Her Late Majesty's historic Platinum Jubilee. And as you said so movingly, Your Majesty, in your address to the nation, we all now feel a sense of loss beyond measure. Nevertheless, the qualities that Her Late Majesty embodied with such constancy remain to inspire you, Your Majesty, your family, and all your subjects.
Lord Speaker John McFall earlier today in Westminster Hall in London. About 900 members of both the House of Lords and House of Commons were in attendance. Also offering condolences, House of Commons Speaker Lindsay Hoyle.
We, Your Majesty's dutiful, loyal subjects, the Commons of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, in Parliament assembled, express deep sympathy felt by this House for the great sorrow which Your Majesty has sustained by the death of the late Queen, Your Majesty's mother. Extended to all the royal family the deep sympathy of this House in their grief, which is shared by all its members. Assure Your Majesty that Her late Majesty's unstinting dedication over a reign of over 70 years to the service of our great country and its people, and to the service of the countries and the peoples of the rest of the wider Commonwealth, which will always be held affectionate and grateful remembrance. And to express to Your Majesty our loyalty to you and our conviction that you will strive to uphold the liberties and to promote the happiness of the people in all your realms, now and in years to come.
House of Commons Speaker Lindsay Hoyle in Westminster Hall earlier today in London. And The Guardian reported that King Charles paid tribute to his mother in what they called an often personal address. He quoted Shakespeare's Henry VIII, saying the Queen had been, quote, a pattern to all princes living. He also said how touched he had been to see the various monuments in Parliament to her jubilees. Here's more from King Charles.
As I stand before you today, I cannot help but feel the weight of history which surrounds us and which reminds us of the vital parliamentary traditions to which members of both houses dedicate yourselves with such personal commitment for the betterment of us all. Parliament is the living and breathing instrument of our democracy. That your traditions are ancient, we see in the construction of this great hall, and the reminders of medieval predecessors of the office to which I have been called, and the tangible connections to my darling late mother we see all around us, from the fountain in New Palace Yard, which commemorates the late Queen's Silver Jubilee, to the sundial in Old Palace Yard for the Golden Jubilee, the magnificent stained glass window before me for the Diamond Jubilee, and so poignantly and yet to be formally unveiled, your most generous gift to Her Late Majesty to mark the unprecedented Platinum Jubilee, which we celebrated only 3 months ago, with such joyful hearts. The great bell of Big Ben, one of the most powerful symbols of our nation throughout the world, and housed within the Elizabeth Tower, also named for my mother's Diamond Jubilee, will mark the passage of the late Queen's progress from Buckingham Palace to this Parliament on Wednesday. My lords and members of the House of Commons, we gather today in remembrance of the remarkable span of the Queen's dedicated service to her nations and peoples. While very young, Her Late Majesty pledged herself to serve her country and her people, and to maintain the precious principles of constitutional government which lie at the heart of our nation. This vow she kept with unsurpassed devotion. She set an example of selfless duty which, with God's help and your counsels, I am resolved faithfully to follow.
King Charles III addressing Parliament in London. Speaking in Westminster Hall is a special honor in the United Kingdom. Queen Elizabeth herself was the last royal to speak there. That happened in 2012 on her Diamond Jubilee. President Obama was the first president to speak there. That happened in 2011. And much has been made of the fate of Queen Elizabeth's stables of horses and, of course, her pet corgis. But what about her bees? Well, the royal beehives that reside within the Buckingham Palace gardens have also been told of the Queen's death. They've also been told that their new master is King Charles and that they should be good to him. The royal bees number in the thousands, and royal beekeeper John Chappell told the Daily Mail that he placed black ribbons tied into bows on the hives and that the centuries-old tradition is rooted in superstition about honey production. Finally today, as we said at the top of the show, President Biden is in Boston to deliver an address on his Cancer Moonshot Initiative. That's his effort to cut the U.S. cancer rate by at least 50% over the next 25 years. He announced the appointment of Renee Wegerzin as the first director of the Advanced Research Projects for Agency for Health. That's an office he created back in March. He also signed an executive order for a new national biotechnology and biomanufacturing initiative that he says will ensure that the biotech efforts to fight cancer are made in America. Here's more from the president in Boston.
We don't do enough to help patients and families navigate the cancer care system. We don't learn enough from their experiences, patients. We don't share enough data and knowledge to bring the urgency we need to finding new answers. But for each of the ways we know cancer today, we know we can change the trajectory. For example, to prevent cancers, scientists are exploring whether mRNA vaccine technology that brought us safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines could be used to stop cancer cells when they first arise. To target the right treatments, we're learning more about how to use genetics, immune response, and other factors to tell which combinations of treatments are likely to work best for each individual. To address inequities, we can ensure prevention, detection, treatment reach patients in urban, rural, suburban, and tribal communities so they have equal access to cancer diagnostics, therapeutics, and clinical trials. As part of the supercharged moonshot, I'll use my authorities as president to increase funding to break log jams into speed breakthroughs. I've also formed a new cancer cabinet that is driving a whole-of-government effort to unleash every possible asset within our power, from NASA, that knows more about radiation than any doctor does, to the Defense Department, that has the ability to calculate, and the Energy Department, do a million billion calculations per second. Health and Human Services, Secretary Becerra plays a key role in the cancer cabinet, as does Marty Walsh, a childhood cancer survivor, who is committed to helping Americans get time off for cancer screenings or care for a loved one. The White House Office of Science and Technology Policy is changing the path for the Cancer Moonshot for 2022 and beyond. And today, I'm setting a long-term goal for the Cancer Moonshot to rally America and ingenuity that we can engage like we did to reach the moon that actually cures cancers, not all cancers, cures for cancers once and for all.
President Biden in Boston announcing the details of his Cancer Moonshot Initiative. You can see more at cspan.org, also on C-SPAN Now. That's our free video app. And a reminder, if you missed any of this program, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you would like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered right to your inbox, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today. We'll be right back.